To honor this year's March Madness, Louis Sines personally handpicked this episode of Perspectives, which originally aired on February 6, 2010.
You're tuned to Perspectives, a weekly public affairs show which airs every Saturday right here on KTEP. Good afternoon. I'm Louis Sines, your host for Perspectives, and joining us today is a very good friend of the station. He's been with us before, and of course, you've heard him call in during our pledge drive. He's a very big supporter of the station, Coach Russ Bradford. And of course, Coach is no longer coaching. He is now an assistant professor at NMSU, but you might remember him as being a coach with the Miners and also with the New Mexico State Aggies. So he's coached with several legends, Coach Henson and Coach Haskins. Russ, thank you very much for being with us here today.
Great to be back home at UTEP.
Now, the last time that we spoke, you were here in your wearing your other hat, wearing your author's hat, and you had just finished writing Patty on the Hardwood. For people who may not remember about that book, tell us a little bit about, guide us through this. How did you get involved going from basketball to writing?
Well, I just burned out. I was tired, and I had always been a big reader. And like a lot of writers, I was a reader who spilled over. I thought that I'd try writing and began taking classes at New Mexico State with Robert Boswell and Antonia Nelson, the two great fiction writers who just recently left New Mexico State. And in 2000, I took a chance and quit coaching to go get a writing degree, a master's degree from New Mexico State's MFA program. I somehow snuck in a pretty prestigious program and then went to Ireland hoping to work on fiction. But immediately I got overwhelmed in Ireland. I thought it would be an easy job, but immediately got overwhelmed with how strange the world of Irish basketball was and started keeping a diary. And that diary became Patty on the Hardwood.
And that was, for people who have not read that book, it's an excellent book. And people will feel right at home reading it because not only do you talk about basketball, about, you know, Russ Bradford, about Coach Haskins, but you also talk about, you know, the Southwest and Miners that you ran into while you were overseas.
That's right. I had this strange coincidence of reconnecting with Antoine Gillespie, the great UTEP player who left UTEP as the career-leading scorer. I think that record has been broken since he left. But it was a strange place to coach. You know, it's a very low level of professional basketball. And I was sort of a wannabe fiddle player. And when I went over there, I was trying to learn the Irish fiddle. So as my team was plummeting into last place, I was sort of taking some solace from the joys of Irish music.
And actually, you're being very humble because you're pretty good in my impression, and you were taking lessons from one of the masters.
That's right, Paddy Jones, who's sort of he's a recluse, but it really helped me, Louis, because I was able to, as I was trying to teach the American tradition of basketball, I was learning the Irish tradition. And I think being a student of a raw beginner in Irish fiddle helped me to understand what the Irish players were going through. That, rather than being frustrated and angry at them for not getting it right away, I was having the same problems with my Irish fiddling. And so that's what the book is about, is sort of contrasting, trying to teach the American basketball while learning the Irish fiddle.
Russ, unfortunately or fortunately, we all come to the crossroads in our lives. And we hear it all the time, especially right now as the NFL season is winding down. We hear a lot about is this coach going to return to coaching? Is this coach going to retire? Is Brett Favre going to retire, et cetera? And you were at those crossroads also because you had to make that decision. Am I going to stay in coaching? Because there was a good possibility, I would imagine, that perhaps there would have been a head coaching job opening for you somewhere, perhaps even at New Mexico State if Coach Henson had stepped down then.
Well, there's a lot of luck involved. And I was very lucky to be with Don Haskins and Lou Henson, but I didn't know if I would ever get the chance to be a head coach. And as it turned out, maybe there was a year that Lou got sick and maybe they would have trusted me with being the interim coach. But even then, I think they would have replaced me with Reggie Theus, a much bigger name. So I just One of the things that happened to me, Lou Henson, you know, Coach Haskins was reasonably happy at the end of his career, and Lou Henson, of course, is always happy, but I think those guys are rarities. I think most coaches are sort of angry and bitter and frustrated by the end of their career, and they're not getting honored and put into the Hall of Fame. There's just a lot of coaches that get fired and things don't work out for them. And it seemed like, and so while I miss the excitement of college basketball, there were some great up days, but there was plenty of down days, and my days were much more level now. Like I'll read a great book and talk to the students about it, and it's very fulfilling. But again, there's a lot of luck involved, and I've been very lucky in my writing career, but just didn't want to wait around in college basketball anymore.
And of course, in writing and in coaching, it's very different. I mean, you guys do a lot of writing, but it's writing, you know, play plans, playbooks, etc. Did you always, when you had in the back of your mind that you wanted to be a writer, did you always want to be a sports writer, or it didn't matter?
No, I wasn't at all. I had stopped reading sports books by the time I was 20. And at New Mexico State, I was trained as a fiction writer. I just had stopped reading sports books at all. I've read a couple since that time, but my idea as a writer was to not be writing about sports. But I think it really helped inform my writing. I think it made me a better writer. I think both with Patty on the Hardwood and now with the new book, with Nolan Richardson's book, 40 Minutes of Hell, I think I'm able to see sort of the big picture and the arc of the book and the change in the characters just sort of anchor the book with a structure that a fiction writer would be able to do, and bring the best qualities of fiction to writing about sports. And I'll also say, Louis, you know, in both books, there's not much actual on-the-court basketball in either book. I counted in the Nolan Richardson book, and there's only 8 pages of basketball in a 300-something-page book. So I don't find the basketball part as interesting, frankly. And I find, especially with Nolan Richardson, I find his historical importance and the social impact of his career to be much more interesting than any on-the-court stuff.
And joining us today is one of our hometown heroes, and that is Coach Nolan Richardson. Of course, he is very humble, so he probably would disagree with the title that I just gave him. And as you remember, we've interviewed Coach Russ Bradford before when he wrote Patty on the Hardwood. But as you are very well aware of, the latest book that Russ has written is 40 Minutes of Hell, and this is the extraordinary life of Coach Nolan Richardson, and I'm very pleased to welcome Coach Richardson back to UTEP. Thanks for being with us here, sir.
Well, thank you very much, Louis. It's certainly a great pleasure to be back home. This has always been my home, and I still call it home, and it's certainly great to be back at the institution that I got my degree from.
And one of the things that I mentioned to Russ, because the title, 40 Minutes of Hell, really stands out. And when I first saw it, I thought, well, maybe he's talking about Coach Haskins, because a lot of his players said that that's what his practices and his games were. But Coach Russ said that this is actually what some of your players talked about, your practices and your games.
Well, that's how the name, the style became the way it is, the 40 Minutes of Hell. It's a very short, brief story. When I first got to Arkansas, we were always playing this style of basketball, but one of the players came in one day at practice and says, "Hey, Coach, are we going to have to have a practice like this every day?" And I said, "Every day." And he says, "Coach, I says, how long?" And usually I put the clock on 40 minutes. That's how long the games are. And, you know, we do a lot of stuff with water balls, medicine ball, jumping ropes, and wind sprints and things of that nature to get your body ready and conditioned. And he says, "Coach, that's 40 minutes of hell." And I said, "Absolutely." And so after we started playing, that same young man who's now an attorney and lives in Memphis, Tennessee, said to the news writer, "You guys are really playing. How do you can play so hard?" He said, "We just put 40 minutes of hell on them." And that started it like a ball of fire back in 1988, 80, 87, something like that. And it just caught on, and it became my game style.
And, of course, those 40 minutes of hell in your game style responsible for your success and also for the championship at the University of Arkansas?
Well, the thing that I also have to give a lot of credit to is Coach Haskins, because we did go through hell. There was not too many players that ever played for him that didn't play as hard as they could, because that was one thing that I took from Coach from the day one, is that, you know, the harder you work, the more better chances you have of winning. And so there's no question that going to Arkansas, I had already experienced winning a national championship at the junior college level. You know, we played that style of basketball. And then I went to Tulsa, and we won the NIT, and that style was there. And, you know, it just was a style that I thought was totally different than most teams around the country during that period. People had to prepare for our team a lot harder than we had to prepare for them. And it was such a different type of game that it didn't have, like, no rules or regulations, and yet it did.
Russ, what made you decide to choose Coach Richardson? Because, you know, if you look at it, it's kind of in the same framework as what Coach Haskins went through, the racism, you know, crossing the color barrier, et cetera. And Coach Richardson experienced a lot of that and more.
Well, that's right. I think both Don Haskins and Nolan Richardson had historically important wins from a racial perspective. You know, Don Haskins with the 1966 team, of course, but Nolan Richardson was the first black coach in the old Confederacy, in the old South, first black head coach at a major state university, meaning a white majority university. But I felt like Nolan was a really compelling subject for a book, you know, partly because, you know, he grew up speaking Spanish in Segundo Barrio. He was the first black kid at Bowie High School. So he has such a unique background, and just sort of the against all odds story of his life. You know, when he began coaching in the 1960s, there wasn't a single black coach at a major school in the major state university in the United States. And so he had no role models to model his career after. And I think a guy who comes along with no role models has to sort of create his own mold. And I think Nolan Richardson really did that. He sort of knocked down doors and had a boldness, even his style of play. I mean, 40 minutes of hell is sort of a shocking, it's a shocking concept. And so I felt from the beginning that he was a compelling subject. And finally, the fact that he grew up a Spanish speaker, was so embraced by the El Paso's Hispanic community, which I should also add, I think everyone's embraced by El Paso's Hispanic community, or that's my experience. But when he couldn't get a job after he got fired, he had to go back to his Spanish-speaking roots, you know, go to Juarez, Mexico, and coach the Mexican Olympic team. So any story that comes full circle, I think, is a compelling story.
It's interesting that you mentioned, or I'm not sure if it was the review that mentioned, that for a long time they didn't even acknowledge that, you know, he won the championship at the University of Arkansas. They would talk about the junior college.
Well, they would, you know, one of the things that happened.
And something else.
Well, I would say that the what happened with Nolan is after he was fired, they sort of he became sort of a persona non grata at the university, and they totally missed his 10-year reunion for that 1994 team that won the championship. But they've changed athletic directors and presidents since then, and they brought him back for the 15-year anniversary. And frankly, Louis, Nolan Richardson seems happier to me today than he did when I first started writing the book. I do think his career and his story and his life are having a happy ending, both with the Mexican team and now with the WNBA. He's the Tulsa coach for the top women's professional league in the world.
There has been a lot said, Coach, and you're, of course, aware of this with the movie Glory Road and other stories of the 66 team, that Coach Haskins opened the door for a lot of African-American athletes. But some people say that because of that and because of you, the door has also been open for African-American coaches.
Well, there's no question. I mean, we, as coaches, many years ago, I remember talking to John Thompson and Chaney, who are African-American coaches and legends in their own times, would tell me, say, man, you need to thank your coach over and over again for us having the opportunity, because until the awareness, you know, a lot of folks, you know, of course, a lot of folks didn't realize that African Americans really weren't involved in a lot of the NCAA tournament games, even though they were, but never had it come that it was five blacks against five whites, and that's exactly what it boiled down to. So it caught the country, the nation, of what happened there. And winning the basketball game opened the doors for other schools, particularly in the South, to start inviting black athletes to play basketball on their teams. And in the meantime, if you're going to continue to do those kind of things, eventually some of those guys are going to have to become coaches. And I think that was the beginning of it.
Because a lot of people have said in the past, who would have ever thought that an African-American coach would have been the coach at the University of Arkansas?
That's true. I mean, I never thought that I would ever had a chance to do that. When I was a young man in my coaching career, even in junior college, I never looked toward the South to ever get a job because we never, ever saw any black coaches in that area. I thought maybe one day I might be the coach at New Mexico or New Mexico State or Arizona, going back the other direction. But never in my wildest of dreams did I even think I would get the job at Tulsa University. But even if I went further than that, I should have started dreaming a little bit differently because I did get a job in a place called Snyder, Texas, right outside of Lubbock, which many, many years going through that area, we couldn't even stay in a hotel or a motel or anything of that nature. So, you know, the times were beginning to change. And like I said, I think Coach Haskins and his ball club had a lot to do with that change.
Now, because of what you just said, Coach, Coach Russ also mentioned that this book will be uncomfortable for some people to read because a lot of people aren't aware of the fact that El Paso did go through those racial times.
That's true. You know, my mother-in-law is from Mexico, and she reads pretty good. And she was explaining the book to her. She had no clue. As a young man, as a kid, the things that we couldn't do, had no clue. There are some people that I have talked to that have probably know a little bit about what's going on. Even though I was raised in the Segundo Barrio or the Pujido Ward, you know, they had no clue that I what things I had to go personally. You know, I couldn't go to the movies with them. I couldn't go swimming with them. You know, I couldn't go to the skating rings with the players. Or it was so many different things, and yet we were so insulated over on the south side with the border being close by, which gave me an opportunity to go to Mexico or Juarez and be a free person as a young man growing up. You know, I couldn't be free and do all the things I wanted to do in my own town, but I could in Mexico. So that's what would make people uncomfortable. The fact is that Russ did a tremendous job in research, and he went from there, from El Paso to Snyder to Tulsa, Oklahoma, to Arkansas. I mean, and you could tell that the more he went south, the more racial it became. And so he just did, to me, a tremendous job of bringing up what happened in El Paso, how it was in its day, and how we changed. And to be honest with you, it probably, of all the cities in America that was under that jurisdiction of can't ride on the bus and things of that nature, it was probably the city that I would call the most colorless. Couldn't see. I mean, they were El Paso. Of course, I was, like I said, spent most of my time in the buoy in the south side. So I never knew what was on the west side of El Paso. I never went to the west side of El Paso to see to be treated any different.
Now, of course, a lot of people have said, well, things have changed now. And, mm-hmm. of course, we have an African-American president,
right.
Which is very historic. But some people say, well, Coach Richardson was coach at Arkansas, and he was accepted. But perhaps that might have changed had he not had a winning record. Do you agree?
Oh, there's no question. there's no, you know, when I got to Arkansas, they had 9,000-seat arena. And in my fifth or sixth, seventh year there, we built an arena, got 19,200, sold out every single basketball game I coached, sold out. And that is a testimony of winning. When you produce on a big campus, a big level, I think I averaged for every ball game, 18 games at $240,000 per game on the home court is an amazing business. And if, you know, you get fired, if you, and you could probably be any coach, but I don't think the patience that a school or an administration would have with an African-American coach as opposed to a white coach. I mean, you can, you know, he took Nolan Richardson's place, and he lasted 5 years, and they fired him when he was winning. And they brought in a coach that basically record was less than the guy that they fired. And so, but he didn't play the style that the Richardson's teams have played, you know, that let's get it up and have people laughing and screaming in the aisles. And so they say that, well, the style is hurting him, but he's still winning. And the years before I took the job, they had Eddie Sutton, and they walked down the floor and did those kind of things. It's really funny. When I first got to Arkansas, you know, there was easy people saying that we played rat ball or nigger ball or helter-skelter ball, you know, and I didn't have the players when I first got to Arkansas that I got a couple of years later. I took the job at Arkansas with a daughter that was sick with leukemia, and in 2 years that I was there, she passed away. And so I spent all my time trying to see to my daughter. But the patience in Arkansas is not that way. I was very fortunate, I guess, to continue to stay there. I, at one time, was wanting to get out. But as you start winning, people forget what color money. It doesn't matter. You know, that. I mean, he's a winner. And so that's what it's all about. You know, I stayed 17 years. And in those 17 years, I faced a lot of different things that some people wouldn't have been able to face, but I had to and was able to do it and was, for most parts, was successful at being at Arkansas.
And even when you left, Coach, that was difficult, wasn't it?
There's no question when I left the arena of coaching. Of course, I was forced out, and I had been, you know, everybody in Arkansas really don't know, and everybody in El Paso don't know, but the chain of trying to get me out happened way before I got out. You know, if I didn't do the things that I was doing, it's just everything was a timing situation for him. You know, when a person says that you have lost confidence, you know, it's amazing when they say you have lost confidence in your program, that's the reason that they'd rather move you, and also say that if a coach makes the statement that if I'm not doing my job, pay me off and I leave tomorrow. I've said that. I make that statement almost anywhere I go. If I don't do my job, I don't deserve the job. And I said that many times. But when you're 31 and 2 and 26 and 4, it doesn't matter. But to me, it's all the same. I mean, I'm just an upfront person. If I'm 9 and 9, if I'm not doing my job, fellas, fire me. So I would have preferred more to be fired for losing
than
for the reason they gave me. You know, that's so what I mean, you know, a coach that have won you a national championship, been to the Final Four 3 times, a school that's in its history has been only twice and 2 different coaches and never having the opportunity in the South of any of those schools winning a national championship. You know, and I told him over and over again, I deserve to have a bad year, and that's the year that I was dismissed.
There's several things in the book that I would say that Nolan and I would have a different opinion on. One of them is I happen to think, from my research, it seemed to me that the president at the time, a man named Dr. John White, was a decent man and forthcoming and honest. I think Nolan has a different opinion of him than I do, but I felt like I wanted to be fair to him. He spoke to me at length, spoke to me for 3 hours, whereas, you know, Frank Broyles, the famous athletic director and former football coach, was completely inaccessible to me. And I should probably add inaccessible to Nolan for many years, even though Nolan worked for him. And so we there was some surprising things that came out during the trial that the book portrays. There's an entire chapter on the trial, and I, you know, was desperately trying not to make the trial part seem like a trial because I think it's really human drama.
Tell us a little bit about the title.
Well, 40 Minutes of Hell refers to his style of play. The college basketball game was 40 minutes long, but originally it came from one of his players at Bowie said to him, they would name the last 40 minutes of practice 40 minutes of hell because it was so physically brutal. And it's one of the interesting paradoxes of Nolan's coaching style is the players invariably loved Nolan, even the ones who weren't the stars. But he was brutal and physical, you know, physically brutal with them, not emotionally brutal, but really tested them physically. And that kind of physical test, as you can imagine, becomes a real mental test of not to quit and to hang in there. And so the 40 minutes of hell originally referred to practice, but then referred to his playing style. And now I think it's almost like a brand name. I think people who know Nolan Richardson know that 40 minutes of hell refers to him.
And some people in the past have referred almost the same thing to Coach Haskins.
Well, that's right. And that's one of the interesting things I learned from the book is how similar in many ways that Don Haskins and Nolan Richardson were. They were both tried to keep things simple. I think both Don Haskins and Nolan Richardson understood that there's a mild complexity to X and O basketball, but the real complexity and the real challenge is there's human beings involved. And in college basketball, it's 12 human beings who are in their 20s. And so there's nothing more complex than juggling those kinds of that kind of mindset among 12 kids. And I think Nolan is really a genius in that regard, that he understands what makes people tick. He understands how to reach people and how to get 12 teenagers on the same page. Is a real anyone who's coached can tell you what a challenge that is, but especially under the kind of pressure cooker that SEC basketball would have been, to get 12 people on the same page takes a real genius of leadership. And I think Nolan has that. And I think it's a different kind of genius than putting together pieces with X and O's.
And I guess what people don't understand, Russ, is, and you understand because you coached as well, the fact that especially college coaches, they're under the gun because they're not just coaches, they're academic counselors. If the kid does something off the court, then the coach gets blamed, whereas in the professionals, of course, you know, it's the athlete.
That's right, and that's another paradox about Nolan's life is that every player I talked to and trainers and assistant coaches said that he talked about academics every day. And then when he had a stretch where he had a poor graduation rate, he lashed out and said, it's not my job to get these guys graduated, where everything he had done up to that point indicated that he believed that it was. So it's one of the interesting paradoxes of Nolan is that he'll lash out if he gets attacked. But in this case, he did stress academics all the time. Nobody graduates all their players, it seems. And he did have a small stretch in there where he had a poor graduation rate. But by the end of his career, he was graduating over 50% of his players, which is more than, you know, the national average for non-athletes. So it is a strange challenge that college basketball coaches are presented with, is that somehow it's their job to get players graduated, whereas if the kid who plays a trombone doesn't graduate, they're not challenging the band director saying, why didn't your kid graduate?
Now, you and Coach Richardson have some similarities because, as you mentioned, Coach Richardson worked with the kids in Bowie and Segundo Barrio, and very few people might not know that you do the very same thing. I mean, you are not from this area, but you've embraced the Southwest, but you have basketball in the Barrio every year.
That's right, and that's actually where I became closer with Nolan, is when I was coaching for Don Haskins every summer, I'd see him and have to reintroduce myself and remind him who I was. But he started coming to, after Rocky Galarza died, who was a good friend of Nolan's, he started coming to basketball in the Barrio. And the first time he came, he just showed up and wanted to speak to the kids. And I said, Coach, the only thing is we're all volunteers. We can't pay you, you know, what you're usually used to. He said, oh, no, I don't want any money. He just wanted to talk to the kids and did a great job. And he started coming every year to basketball in the Barrio. That's basically the, you know, it's practically his rec center, the Armijo Center. So I think, you know, I don't have the roots in the area that Nolan does, and I'm not fluent in Spanish like Nolan Richardson is, but that was one of the things I felt was interesting about his story, is here's an African-American guy who practically thinks of himself as being Mexican. And I think the Hispanic community in El Paso thinks of Nolan as being one of their own. They don't see him as an outsider at all.
Well, Russ, thank you very much for being with us here today. We've been visiting with Coach Russ Bradford and with Coach Nolan Richardson. He is the subject of the Russ Bradford book, 40 Minutes of Hell.
Thank you, Louis.
Perspectives is taped and produced at the KTP Studios, University of Texas at El Paso Communication Building. Full context of both interviews with Coach Nolan Richardson and Coach Russ Bradford can be accessed on our website, ktp.org. You've been tuned to Perspectives. I'm Louis Sines.